So welcome everyone to the public debate on the recent UN report on UN civil society relations. As some of you will know, the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan in 2002 called for a review of UN civil society relations as part of a broad program of reform of the UN. And to this end, he established the panel of eminent persons on UN civil society relations to review UN civil society relations and to look at the major challenges and changes that affect the UN and multilateralism and the relationship of the UN to civil society, and to come up with some recommendations also to the UN. And there is now available a small report, a little glossy report here, which states that the question is not how would the UN like to change, but given how the world has changed, how must the UN evolve its civil society relations to become fully effective and to remain fully relevant? And so with this question in mind, the panel of eminent persons on UN civil society relations consulted extensively across the world, talking to civil society actors, parliamentarians, politicians, and so on. And in June this year, Kofi Annan gave his seal to the report that they produced. So I'm delighted this evening to have several members of the panel of eminent persons on UN civil society relations with us, as well as the recently retired head of the UN Association Office in the UK. And I'm sure our panel needs no introduction, but I'm still going to say a few words. In our center, we have Senor Fernando Henrique Cardoso, the former president of Brazil from 1995 to 2002. And as I'm sure all of those of you who have had any contact with development issues will know, that he is also a very distinguished Brazilian sociologist as well as politician. He was an opponent of Brazil's military dictatorships and spent time in exile from 1964 to 1968. When he returned home, he was arrested and banned from teaching and had his political and civil rights suspended. Then he was elected to the Brazilian Senate from the state of São Paulo in 1986, and 2 years later founded the Social Democratic Party. He has served as foreign minister in Brazil, as minister of economy, turning the economy around, and later became president of Brazil. In December 2002, he received the Mahbub El Haq Award for Outstanding Contribution to Human Development. And in February 2003, he was appointed chair of the panel of eminent persons on UN civil society relations. And next to him on the right is John Clark. John Clark served for 1 year in Kofi Annan's office as project director in charge of the secretariat for this special panel on UN civil society relations. For the last 12 years, he's been working in the World Bank, mainly in the NGO civil society unit, and at the moment he is the lead social development specialist for East Asia and the Pacific in the World Bank. He's also had very, very long experience of working with NGOs, primarily with Oxfam, and he also was a fellow at the Centre for Civil Society recently. On my right I have Malcolm Harper, who is a recently retired executive director of the United Nations Association London office. He has enormous international experience and has worked for many years in Africa and for NGOs and for a very long time with Oxfam. He's played a leading role in promoting the work of the UN from his position as the former executive director of the UNA and supporting the work of the panel on UN civil society relations. And on my far right, I have Malini Mehera, who was also a panel member of the panel of eminent persons on UN civil society relations, and it was representing in that capacity India. She is also the founder and director of the Centre for Social Markets, which is an independent non-profit organisation with offices in India and the UK. So I believe she buzzes back and forth between India and the UK and Northern Ireland. And the Centre for Social Markets, I'm told, is dedicated to making markets work for the triple bottom line, for the people, for the planet, and for profit. She also, like John, has extensive experience of working for NGOs in Oxfam and Friends of the Earth, and also in the UN and other multilateral agencies. So we have this evening a very well-informed and illustrious group of panelists, and I will ask each of them to speak in turn for about 10 minutes, and then we will open up to the floor for questions. So we'll start with President Cardoso.
Well, thank you very much, dear friends. Let me say that I'm very pleased with this opportunity to share with you the main message and proposals of the report on UN and civil society relations presented last June, as has been said just now, to the Secretary General Kofi Annan. John Clark, to my right, the panel's executive director, and Malina Mera, one of the 12 panel members, will help me in this task. The panel was established with the mission to review the existing experience and develop practical proposals to improve UN's engagement with civil society and other non-state actors. Our starting point was the realization that the UN civil society relationship had grown exponentially over the preceding decades. But with progress also came difficulties and tensions. NGOs felt frustrated with the obstacles to substantive participation in policy making and in the implementation of agreed programs. On the other side, member states felt that civil society participation in decision making was undermining the intergovernmental process. It was essential to reduce distrust, demonstrate the effectiveness of collaboration, and build consensus around new ways of working together. In our process of consultation, we are guided by some basic assumptions. First, global governance is no longer the sole domain of governments. Second, the growing participation and influence of non-state actors is enhancing democracy and reshaping multilateralism. Third, civil society organizations are the prime movers of some of the most innovative initiatives to deal with emerging global threats. Given how the world has changed, as you said, we challenge the UN also to undertake a profound cultural change, a kind of a paradigm shift. To remain effective, the UN needs to reach out beyond its core membership of central governments and make full use of the capacities brought by a diverse of actors, NGOs, the private sector, parliamentarians, local authorities, the media, so on and so forth. We were aware that many member states might react very strongly to any enlarged role of non-state actors. This is normal. We therefore acknowledge that as an intergovernmental organization, the power to decide in the UN would remain with the member states. But we also recognize that the power to shape the agenda, influence decisions, mobilize resources, and ensure implementation is now open to all the people. You know, this is a very important point. As you know, the United Nations Charter was the result of a kind of big coalition of the Second World War. And the decision was taken by member states, those who have been victorious of the Second World War. And even the participation was not based on democracy, it was based on force, those who have been victorious there. On the other hand, the Charter has, since the beginning, a very clear reference to we the people. So there's a kind of tension between member states and the people. Member states are the organizer, the founder, they take the decision. But people want to participate more and more, and in the process of deliberation. So that's the game is all time like that. To what extent we open doors to allow a broader participation, keeping simultaneously the power by member states. Keeping the power is a way to express, because practically power is being also diffused more and more and more because of people's pressure on the UN. So our proposals affirm four main principles. First, the need to reinterpret multilateralism to mean multi-constituencies. In the past, governments negotiated global agreements that UN agencies and member states then implemented. Today, multiple allies and networks bring together civil society, business, and government in joint initiatives of public debate, policy dialogue, and pioneering action. Most of these strategic alliances were developed within the UN system itself. The panel feels that these new forms of interaction are to be valued and extended. The UN should strengthen its governing role, its unique capacity to galvanize all constituencies and bring together different parties to tackle global problems. The second principle is the importance of multi-stakeholder partnerships. These flexible arrangements have emerged as effective ways of getting things done. They ensure that resources of diverse actors are pooled together to deal with critical problems. The key message here is that all those with a stake in the problem should be included in the approach to solving it and in the implementation of the solution. I must say that since the Rio conference in 1992, this is, as a matter of fact, is occurring like that. You see, it was a very important point in the development of the relationship between UN and other actors. This is already something which exists, but we have to reinforce the point that we have to give more attention to multi-stakeholder partnership. The third principle is the challenge of linking local level with the global. The deliberative and operational spheres of the UN work are separated by a wide gulf. This gap must be bridged. Operational programs at the national level must help realize the global goals, and global deliberations must be informed by local reality. We are also recommending that priorities should be put on interaction with civil society at the country level. This is, again, for those who are involved with the UN initiatives, it's not difficult to understand why we are emphasizing the necessity of this, bridging between the local and the global and the national. The fourth principle is the need to overcome democratic deficits in global governance. The role of civil society and public opinion in creating global public space for debate and action is at the heart of democratic governance. Citizens are increasingly using civil society channels to participate in the discussion of global issues. Public opinion influences international deliberations. All these trends represent great opportunities for the UN. We are also suggesting a more systematic UN engagement of parliamentarians and local authorities. These non-central state actors cannot be considered as part of civil society, but they play a relevant role in connecting people and communities with the issues that affect them. Again, this may be a little bit controversial point, because some NGOs believe that, parliamentarians are not properly part of civil society. And as a matter of fact, conceptually speaking, it's true, they are not part. As well as local authorities, they belong to the state. They are, some aspects of the state at the local level. But anyhow, taking into account realities, we believe that it's important to utilize all these factors and forces and actors together to try to, to turn not just easy but more effective the deliberations by the UN. We see this opening up of the UN, the plurality of constituencies, not as a threat to governments, but rather as a powerful way to reinvigorate the intergovernmental process itself. In this spirit, we have also addressed the sensitive question often raised by governments of civil society legitimacy and accountability. New roles and rights always entail new responsibilities. NGOs have to address these questions in the same way they have always urged governments and the private sector. In our report, we are challenging them to develop their own rules of conduct and processes of self-organization. This is, again, I think is very important. To give more moral strength to NGOs, since NGOs are all time making criticism to governments by saying, they have to be much more accountable, they have to have legitimacy to take decisions, the reverse is also true. NGOs have also to have to make an effort to become much more accountable and to act based on some very, very clear rules. So we reiterate the importance of understanding and respecting the source of civil society legitimacy. It does not come from an electoral mandate or a membership base. The legitimacy of civil society organizations derives from what they do, the cause they promote, and not from whom they represent. We also accept that civil society is not only diverse and multifaceted, it is also deeply divided on its political options. All this makes the debate about civil society legitimacy a very complex one. But note in our report, it's quite clear that we are not asking NGOs to represent in the normal sense of the word, because they are not, the base of legitimacy for NGOs is not the representation, it's the cause they are, you know, they are advocating. They have to prove that they are right. And they to some extent, they can create a constituency, not by the fact that the constituency vote. On the contrary, because people adhere to positions proclaimed by NGOs. And, but this is a process of legitimation of the NGOs. Trust and recognition in this field are never attain once and for all. They can only begin in the arena of public opinion and must be continually renewed. So this is the challenge NGOs have to face. They have every day, you know, regain legitimacy in the arena of public opinion. It's quite different from government or for elected people. They receive a mandate for a period of time. Some of them never receive any mandate. They just have power. But then, let's put apart those and refer to democratic, you know, representatives. They have a mandate. That's not the case of NGOs. The NGOs have to repeat it again and again to be in permanent contact with public opinion in such a way that they have to gain legitimacy in the day by day. So these are the main ideas we present in this document. And now I'll ask you, John, to summarize the panel's recommendations that translate these so general principles I just referred to into operational proposals. Please, John, have the floor.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be back with you, sir, and Malini, my old friends with the panel, but it's also very good to be back here at the LSE. So it's an important evening for me. Going through the four main principles that President Cardoso just summarized, the first is that multilateralism has changed. The observation that the panel made was that a lot of the most important changes, big changes in global policy these days, comes not through the formal processes of the UN, but the informal processes, in particular from the global, what we call the global policy networks, where NGOs, other actors in civil society, UN agencies, governments, local authorities, sometimes private sector, intellectuals and others all come together because they share an interest in that issue. Now, a lot of this has evolved in an informal process. The panel is suggesting that one of the most important principles is to say the UN could play a proactive role in recognizing that that is a major way of multilateralism working today, and that therefore to be proactive by using opportunities, using the convening role that the UN has, the moral authority in the convening role it has, to deliberately, on key issues, bring the relevant stakeholders together. For example, we're suggesting before the General Assembly discusses an important issue, perhaps there could be a two-day multi-stakeholder, high-level multi-stakeholder interactive process before then that gives governments a chance to hear from key experts in different perspectives on that issue. We're also suggesting that the General Assembly's specialised committees, of which there are a number, that those at present comprise only governments. Now, very occasionally, they have NGOs that are allowed to come and listen, but we're suggesting a cautious process of opening up those General Assembly committees to inputs from civil society organisations. On the second principle of realizing the power of partnerships. I won't say very much more, but again, it was an observation that if you look at some of the most effective practical programs in the UN system, whether it's to do with tackling environmental issues, health problems, HIV/AIDS, or whatever, that some of the most important advances these days come when the energies of civil society, governments, and sometimes the private sector, and often local authorities, all are harnessed for a common cause. And that the UN could do much more to galvanise those sorts of partnerships, but wouldn't be able to unless the Secretary-General himself uses his convening power. And therefore, if he established a special office in his cabinet that could help move that with resources to make it possible, then we could see much more exciting partnerships in the future. The third principle is the linking the global with the local. And this really came as a result of the very widespread consultative process that the panel had, in which the panel was sort of hearing very different messages in New York and Geneva and some of the industrialized countries, and very different from the messages that it tended to hear in developing countries. In developing countries, the message was one of, we want to influence the UN about what's going on in our country, the UN's activities in our countries. And there was this talk that they're aware of UN resolutions on this, that, and the other, but they felt there was a disconnect between that world at the global level that was really to do with New York and Geneva and was miles away from their experience. So the panel felt that, in a sense, it was really important to link much more organically this global policy debate about the important issues, especially when it comes to the Millennium Development Goals, the global development targets, and the actual more day-to-day work at the country level. And the way to do that was to establish a very intensive dialogue in the country level, at the country level, to have someone working with the resident coordinator to make that possible, but to ensure that policy ideas from that country level experience gets fed up into the global policy making, but also that would help make sure that what goes on at the country level really does reflect the realities on the ground, but also reflects the global consensus on those issues. So we felt that having forums for discussion with the leading civil society actors at the country level, having a key advisor working with the resident coordinator at the country level would help that. We also felt with the Security Council over the recent years has actually expanded its debate with civil society, but it tends to be very much a debate with civil society who has offices in New York. And what we're suggesting is that the processes, the mechanisms for that, be broadened to put a great emphasis on bringing in civil society from the conflict-affected countries, from the countries which the Security Council is discussing, and much more emphasis on the Security Council getting out into the field themselves, and when they get out into the field themselves, meeting with civil society at the country level. The fourth principle is the one of tackling the democracy deficits. And here, the panel was very much exercised with the paradox, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, which is that in this globalized world that we live in, the issues, the substance of politics, whether it's HIV/AIDS, the environment, global terrorism, whatever, the substance of so much of political debate has become globalized. And yet the processes of democratic debate remains firmly at the national level or sub-national level. So the panel was exercised with how could the UN contribute to helping to bridge that paradox. Obviously, one way is to find more effective channels to bring civil society actors into the global discussions. But we felt that there were other priorities as well. Through democratic processes, citizens do elect representatives, both at local authority levels and at national parliamentary levels. And the panel looked at ways in which the UN could use its offices, again, more systematically, to engage those representatives in discussions of matters of global importance. One specific idea The Secretary General has since said that he likes and he's suggested an experimental mechanism around the issue of HIV/AIDS on, but is that at the national parliamentary level, some of the most effective parliamentary debate tends to take place at the level of select committees, we'd call them in the UK, congressional committees in the United States, but where parliamentarians are elected by their party, they have a formal role for the parliament to discuss a particular issue, whether it's agriculture or AIDS or whatever. And that's all very well and good when that issue is really under the authority of the national government. But when the issue in question is really a globally determined issue, you need a global equivalent of those select committees with parliamentarians from a variety of different countries to come together, all of whom have responsibility within their parliament on that issue. And if they could come together, and we have suggest a formula that could make that workable, then that could be the beginnings of a global parliamentary mechanism. The panel felt that it was perhaps unrealistic today to suggest what might be an important idea for the 22nd century of a global parliament. But this could be a mechanism to allow parliamentarians to have a global mandate. So those were the sort of four broad principles, and obviously there was a number of more administrative proposals that we made to do with a special office in the Secretary General's office to take forward these ideas, the idea of having a fund to help build up the capacity of Southern civil society, because we're very mindful that it's easy to say Southern civil society should be more engaged in all of this, but they don't at present have the resources or sometimes the capacity for this, so we felt a fund was necessary for that. And the panel felt that the accreditation mechanism for NGOs at the UN at the moment is very, very time-consuming, very over-politicised, and so the panel's suggesting a more simple and less politicised accreditation process to make all that possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Well, the only person on the panel who wasn't on the panel. it's very good to be here. Everybody said twice already everything I wanted to say, so I'll keep it short, due for you. But I think there are a number of issues really looking at it from the non-governmental civil society side, where we have really got our own work to do to make sure that we come up to scratch in the standards and the values that we demand of governments and UN agencies and those on the official side of the line. And after nearly 40 years in the NGO world, there is quite a democratic deficit still in civil society, non-governmental organisations. I'm not going to mention names, but I can think of a number of large, medium and small NGOs whom I would consider to be nearer to self-serving oligarchies than they are to being real expressions of the popular will of their membership. And it's very easy for us to take the moralistic line, oh, governments are terrible, UN should do this, blah, 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 and we don't actually look in at ourselves. The old physician heal yourself philosophy, I think, is something that hopefully this report will help to develop further. Because I think this report is one of the most important that the UN has produced in the last 10 or 20 years. It really does give an opportunity for a much wider, intense and creative dialogue between the member states and the secretariat of the UN and its agencies and programs and, quote, civil society, unquote, however we define it. So I think that if we want to have that conversation going forward as creatively as it should, we have some work to do on our side while we ask the other side to do its work. Secondly, I know this is massively unpopular in the NGO world, we really do have to sit down and have a long, hard think in the 21st century as to what is the role of the corporate sector. Some of these companies are so massively influential and wealthy now that you can turn your back on them and say they are the work of the devil and we must have nothing to do with them. I remember at the time of the first Gulf War, nothing to do with the corporate sector, when some of us were going down to talk to the Foreign Office about not using the military against Saddam Hussein in order to get him out of Kuwait, but to allow other things more time to see whether they would come to fruition. And there were a lot of people who thought we just sold out and we were the work of the devil. Having this conversation with the government when it was quite clear we should all be standing outside number 10 shouting our slogans and waving our flags. And I'm not against shouting our slogans and waving our flags. But it's very easy for powerful organs, in this case the Foreign Office, actually to close the windows and to shut the doors and to hear nothing of what we are saying. And they carry on as though we don't exist. And I do think there has got to be the courage to have a much more intense dialogue, trying to see what, if anything, we have in common and how we can build on them, and where we have nothing in common, how we actually start to create something of a common agenda. Because I believe that in terms of civil society, without the corporate sector in this period of time, we are doing ourselves a potentially great damage, because they will go off and do their own thing in their own way with much more power than we will ever have in the NGO civil society movements. And I think that's something which is difficult, but is very necessary. I would also like to talk about the country level, because I think it is terribly important that these processes and your discussion, John, on issues, HIV/AIDS or education for all, whatever, actually grow from the bottom up and aren't just plonked down from the top. I was at a meeting earlier today where we had Miles Wicksteed, who's the head of the Africa Commission. And he was saying, because NEPAD is a very important part of this process, blah, blah, blah. And all the NGOs saying, well, hang on a minute, NEPAD is terribly top down. Where is its relationship with the bottom up? And my experience when I worked with Oxfam in Africa and with others was that at that point in time, the UN was very much top down. It was not really engaged also in a bottom up process. And I believe that at the country level, to have a really genuine dialogue between national or even community civil service, civil society groups and NGOs with the UN is important. And because, from bitter experience, one knows there are a number of governments, not only but not least in the developing world, who are very cautious about civil society and really feel quite threatened by them and see them as enemies rather than as potential partners, I think the UN has a really important role to play to bring that conversation about, and there's probably nobody else who can do it in the way that the UN can. So it's a very important role I think the UN should be playing. I'm delighted that at long last it's going to be, well, John and I had a conversation over a sandwich earlier today. I said it's very good to see that the procedures for accreditation are being simplified and streamlined. I said, no, they're being relaxed. It was a slight play on words. But I think it is important that, you know, there are so many NGOs that have applied for accreditation through the dreaded ECOSOC and have waited, what, John, 5, 6, 7 years? Well, you do. Your enthusiasm does wane if you have a 7-year wait. And I do think that that whole area of accreditation and streamlining it, simplifying it, and that for the UN to be able to make judgments as to whether people who are wishing to be accredited really are genuine participants in the process or are self-serving oligarchies, and the UN should have the courage to be able to say, no, we don't think you are a suitable partner for this process, or thank you very much, we think you're wonderful, and please come in. And it may be that the UN can help some of those NGOs to reform themselves if being part of the system of accreditation is very important. So I hope we'll have a really good discussion tonight on this and many other issues, and I look forward to participating in it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jude. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My thanks, first of all, to Jude for organising this event, this conversation with all of you. I think it's really important that members of the panel who've gone through a real baptism by fire in our consultation process over the course of the 1 year that we consulted with a variety of constituencies all over the world have an opportunity now to share with you the actual recommendations that we came up with and have these kind of fora and go on road shows across the country, etc. So this really is wonderful because it's the first one that I've attended, participated in after the report was presented to the General Assembly by the Secretary General. What I want to do quickly, because I know you must be tiring of listening to all of these talking heads at the table up here. We're very much interested in a dialogue with you, so I'm going to keep it short. But I'm going to focus on a little bit of history and a little bit of next steps. The little bit of history is, like many of you in the room, I think, we're from similar generations. I spent many of my formative years, the 1990s, engaged with the United Nations, whether it was through school, United Nations, the associations, or whether it was working on grassroots issues and making a link, domestic violence, homelessness, etc., making that link with what was happening at the national level, parliamentarians, discussions on these issues, and of course the United Nations system. People of my generation found that increasingly the doors were opening. We've been banging away at the beginning of the 1990s for us to be heard by the multilateral system, and we started that banging at the door process very much with the Bretton Woods institutions at the beginning of the 90s. But with 1992 and the UNCED conference in Rio, it was like the floodgates opened. And there was such a complete and utter wave of, and you know all about it, you've been following the global summit processes, you know how the numbers just expanded, you know, geometrically, such that we went from something like just 900 groups who'd been accredited with ECOSOC at the beginning of the 1990s to well over 2,500 when the new millennium began. So that period, the 1990s, saw a wonderful embrace, a real opening of the multilateral system to civil society voices. Now, however, there's a real period of taking stock, and there's a real sense by governments who weren't, you know, happy clapping on the sidelines of this process always, that, oh my God, you know, what creature have we created? And so now I want to talk about the next steps part of it. Now there really is a process of, okay, battening down the hatches, let's consolidate from the part of government, let's look at actually what we have loosed upon the world during the 1990s, and let's see whether we can manage it. So when we started on the panel process, there were a number of suspicions from the non-governmental organizations, in particular as a subsection of civil society, who said, hang on a sec, this is just a ploy to do two things. One, it's to reduce the access that NGOs have had to the United Nations system, and secondly, it's to let in the private sector from the back door, and it's none of the above. Certainly, those two principles were ones which we were absolutely adamant to defeat from the very beginning. We said this is a process of enhancing civil society participation, and secondly, it is about enhancing not just civil society but other actors, the various different constituencies that must be supportive of multilateralism, whether it's local government, parliamentarians, trade unions, the media, and the private sector. Now, however, what we're finding is, I'm going to bring my comments now to focus on the reality right now. At the end of the summer, as you know from the predecessors who've spoken already, we presented our reports to the Secretary General in June of this year. In September, the Secretary General then presented his own report, and he picked not all of them, but a number of the recommendations that we'd made, and he submitted those for consideration to the General Assembly. In October, the 4th and the 5th of October, there was a two-day debate within the General Assembly on issues of reform and revitalization at the United Nations. And this report and its recommendations were a subject of the discussions. Now, there wasn't whooping and clapping in the General Assembly debate, I can tell you. There were about 40 countries, and you can read all of the comments that member states made, 40 countries, their representatives, who provided a feedback. And it ranged from the very, very minimal China, which was, oh yes, we think it's a good idea, but we think it requires more consideration. Hello, have you read the report? probably not. That was the kind of minimalist response to one which was much more generous and considerate. And the Netherlands, speaking on behalf of the European Union, was generous and considerate, said, okay, you know, here are a couple of the things that we would like to take forward. For example, the idea proposed by the Secretary General, John's just spoken of it, that there should be a national consultations on issues like HIV/AIDS, and it should perhaps be discussed by the General Assembly with specialists on HIV/AIDS, because there's a big summit next year. So there was a real range in the debate at the General Assembly. But by and large, it didn't reach a resolution. And there were countries which presented themselves as champions. And in order for reports like this actually to see the sight of day and to have their recommendations actually stand the chance of implementation, you need champions. You need a group of member states to say, okay, we're prepared to put together a resolution. And there isn't actually, Brazil is spearheading efforts to put together a resolution which will be discussed hopefully within the next couple of weeks, such that the report will then have a thread by which it hangs on. So the General Assembly, which is discussing it now, will make a decision hopefully. Okay, we want to have one or two items to be brought over into the discussion next year. That's where things are with regard to the General Assembly discussions. But I want to bring this into the bigger picture of what's happening on issues of civil society engagement with the United Nations. As many of you will know, 2005 is a really big year. You've got a number of big summits. You've got the high-level debate, your high-level meeting on HIV/AIDS. You've got the Millennium Plus 5. You've got the, you know, Copenhagen Plus 10. You've got Beijing Plus 10. And the word that I'm hearing from people who are involved with the accreditation process at the UN is that we are really losing ground. So many of the headways that we had become accustomed to, having a very large number of NGOs very easily accredited to these conferences, is actually not even up for discussion. At this point, in the year just before a mega series of summits, there should already be a very easy and transparent process of accreditation for civil society organizations, and that's not happening. And people in the know are saying this is signaling that there is actually a chill wind blowing, and that member states are now trying to, you know, to basically pare back the level of access that has been enjoyed so far. And their reaction to the panel's recommendations will really be indicative of whether those fears are correct or whether they're just the paranoid ramblings of, you know, people who want to see complete and utter freedom for NGOs within the United Nations. So that's a cautionary note that I just want to sound at this point, because I don't want you people to leave this wonderful old theater thinking, everything's happy in the world. There has been this panel which has made some very bold, some very challenging, but some very modest, reasonable, and doable, in the words of our panel member from Iran, recommendations. And this gentleman, Mr. Ambassador Azadi, who's from Iran, it was amazing because he is someone who used to chair the G77 in the United Nations. And if you know the G77, their positions haven't always been entirely warm to NGO access. And for someone with his degree of experience with the United Nations to say that the recommendations that we've come up with are not threatening to the entire edifice of intergovernmental principles, but actually they are modest, they are reasonable, and they are doable, signifies that we can do something with the panel's recommendations. But we do need champions, and we need member states to be lobbied by their people, because otherwise the process will be taken over by the bureaucrats who sit in missions and speak on our behalf in New York. So that's really what I want to say, and I'm looking forward to the discussion now. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, everyone, for keeping to time and that all wonderful presentations. And I'm sure the audience have many, many questions to ask, so would like to open up the floor. I suggest that we take two questions at a time, and one or two panel members will respond to them. Thank you. Marlies, and the gentleman up here. So first.
Hi, I'm Marlies Glacius. I'm a lecturer at the Centre for Civil Society.
Yeah, please, can you give your name and your affiliation when you ask questions?
Done. I just have some concern, although I think there's some very valuable and useful recommendations in the report. about a slight mismatch that I detect between the kind of reasons for engaging with civil society, the grand project that's set out at the beginning of the report, and some of the actual proposals that follow. At the beginning of the report, there's a little discussion about how there's problems with representative democracy in a globalizing world, but that there's also some good news in a kind of enhancing of participatory democracy, which means that any citizen of the world can take part in a global debate. Then a few pages further, the report observes that in practice, of course, not everyone can take part in these debates, in particular UN-led debates. And I cannot square that circle any more than the panel can. It is a real conundrum. But what I find a bit problematic when I look at the actual proposals is that the route that the panel seems to be going is towards expertise. There's a proposal that says we should go back to the original reason for accreditation, which is an acknowledged expertise in a particular field. And it speaks of disciplined networking and peer review of civil society. Now, I think if you really say that the UN has a convening role in participatory democracy, then expertise can't be the whole thing. Surely promoting of causes, as President Cardoso said, should be an important point. And I think although you cannot let everyone in, maybe a solution is to try and get wide diversity of views in, and in particular very contesting views. If you really want to have a convening role in a kind of form of participatory democracy, then that should be include very contested views. For instance, just to give an example, on views of abortion policies. You have groups that call themselves the women's movement, and you have groups that call themselves pro-life. But I think you need to hear, not because of their expertise on the unborn child, but because of their passionately held views. And I think if you speak of trying to get disciplined networks that the UN can then convene, you will start excluding exactly these very contested views. And you would end up not with we the peoples, but we the experts.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much. And I'll take the question here with me. If you can pass the microphone down. So we'll have this one more question then, have responses from the panel.
Thank you. I found your proposal is really very interesting.
Yes,
and Brunhuis King's College, London. And I was just wondering, I mean, basically picking up where you left, I mean, states still have a huge power in terms of blocking this. I mean, you still have to get a resolution passed and all that. And actually, I was interested on the reaction of one of the countries that you didn't mention, which was the U.S., I mean, if you think of all these kind of completely outrageous ideas of the UN as this kind of global conspiracy to dominate the world or some, I mean, if you start talking about moves towards a global parliament, I mean, I would imagine that would create huge problems in the US and to the US government. So, I mean, to what degree is this realistic? And just to add to that, I mean, you didn't mention anything about churches. I mean, I know there's a special process of accreditation and all that, I believe, to the UN, but to what degree do you think, I mean, some of your recommendations are also interesting in terms of bringing the churches in and whether, I mean, sometimes NGOs and churches conflict, but I think still their input is very important. I mean, they have this kind of grassroots quality that is very important. Thank you.
With respect to the first question, I think it's a very important question. As John said, we are expecting the 22nd century to solve all these problems, you see? And even being very cautious in making our recommendations, as you said, and maybe risking to transform we the people into we the experts, the reaction was very strong by member states. Imagine you if we can put bluntly what we really want. It's still more difficult. This is a process. We have to understand, we have to gain more space in the UN. It is also important to recall that the civil society has instruments to organize by itself, you see, and to be more active. And Anyhow, the UN is an association of member states. We've been surrounded by the civil society. It's like a kind of a war in the other civil society, step by step, trying to penetrate more and more. What we are trying to show and to convince the governments is that this is good. This is a positive step ahead, because if we don't have the support by civil society, well, the UN resolutions are dying. Just maybe a decision taken at the level of General Assembly nobody knows about. So the interconnection between the whole process of civil society at the global level with UN is just starting. Started, as we say, you said, and we said too, in 92 practically. See? So we are just trying to enlarge a little bit more that space. But we agree with you. We have to avoid this, to transform with the people into with the experts. We need experts, but the NGOs are not composed by experts. When we refer to NGOs, I refer also to social movements represented by NGOs. Yeah? So we are opening up space for social movements, not just, technical people. See? But you're right. In your observation, you have to move with some political caution. But maybe Marlene could now continue.
If I can just come back to that. That's a great soundbite. We the people or we the experts. Actually, what we've been doing with the panel report, if you look at the recommendations, you have to read them holistically. Our effort was, we knew in our consultations and from our own experience, you can engage with the United Nations in many different ways. You can engage at the national level. You can have an affiliation through your UN association. You can work as an implementer through UNDP. You can work as a funder, which many NGOs do for the United Nations, not as supplicants, but as people who actually fund them. So there are lots of ways in which you can have a relationship. You can interact with the United Nations. We focused on all of those. So we said, okay, we want to make sure that we are making a very compelling case for countries to increasingly train, because it's required, those who are working within the United Nations family on how they should go about interacting with civil society and other actors, because this is not generally done. We said, however, we recognize that if you want to officially interact with the United Nations system, you have very cumbersome processes. You have to, sacrifice 10 lambs and, say 1,000 Hail Marys to ECOSOC before you get ECOSOC consultative status. I mean, who wants to do that anymore? People are completely turned off by it. So we said we have to make some very sensible and doable recommendations with regard to the accreditation process. And this is, there is a committee in the United Nations called the Committee on NGOs, which is comprised of member states. Member states are the ones who make the decision. It's a highly politicized committee, and that committee is the one that says yay or nay to NGOs who, seek accreditation. So we said rather than have these multifarious means of formalizing your relationship with the United Nations, which is, through DPI or through the conference summits or through ECOSOC accreditation systems, let's just have one single. And this is one of the recommendations that the Secretary General then put forward. So now in the General Assembly, there are those who say, yes, we welcome this. And there are those who say, absolute rubbish, we want nothing of this because we want to maintain the monopoly of member states to determine through the Committee on NGOs who comes in and who doesn't. So actually what we're arguing is a much more pluralistic way of engaging for people, from your homes to your boardrooms with the United Nations. The second quick one is... Yeah, on churches and the U.S. issue. Okay, in the General Assembly, the United States and my country, India, were of the same opinion. Basically, they said, just to paraphrase, their position was, in the report, we had not made a compelling enough reason for the rules within the United Nations to be changed such that NGOs have access anything beyond ECOSOC. They don't want things to change. They're very happy with the way things are right now. Now, as far as the churches are concerned, we had a number of consultations with faith-based groups. And there are a number of ways in which they communion with the United Nations system. Of course, they do already through the World Council of Churches for the Christian churches. And increasingly, they're organizing themselves in much more ecumenical ways. But again, because of the parlance, the language within the United Nations is of NGOs. So you have to register yourself as an entity and then get accredited as an NGO. And that's open to whether it's private sector associations or whether it's faith-based groups. That's the way that you get in.
Okay, thank you very much. Do you want to add to that? let's take some more questions. The lady at the back, and she takes some of the gentlemen here.
Hi, my name is Vinita, and I'm a student at LSE. I wanted to ask, civil society and liberal democracy in the current form are both very westernized, very northern concepts, and the main purpose of civil society is often considered to be to provide a counterweight to the nation state, or in some cases to actually undermine it. We've seen, now people are talking of global governance, and a lot of people see this as a way of meddling into the internal affairs of nation states through civil society. And one of the reasons they see for current love affair between IMF and World Bank and civil society is this is one way to get into nation states where they could not earlier. How far is UN willing to support civil societies in such conditions, in such matters? And one more question about the accreditation process. How far is UN willing to look at southern civil societies, which are not mirror images of northern civil societies, and how are they going to go about it? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. The gentleman up here.
Thank you. Peter Willits at City University, and I've worked on this field for about 20 years. This panel is a very eminent, very diverse group. And as is often the case with such a diverse group, the report has diverse things within it. And I think there are two very different strands, one of which I applaud, one of which I deplore. One strand is the democratization, transparency, the need to open up the system, make sure the world as a whole knows more about the UN and the UN knows more about the world. All those aspects are excellent, and some of the innovatory ideas about, for example, links to parliaments, I think, are wonderful. But there is a couple of other strands, a populist strand, which implies somehow the people are more legitimate than governments, which I think is absolute nonsense, except in dictatorships. There is also a strand of corporatism, this emphasis on multi-stakeholder dialogues, on constituencies. This is profoundly anti-democratic, because the question is, if you have such dialogues, who chooses the constituencies, and who chooses who represents those constituencies? And if you start saying that that should be done by the UN Secretariat, if you start following along Malcolm's line, which logically follows from the report, that the UN Secretariat alone should have the right to reject NGOs, you're becoming very anti-democratic. I'm afraid democracy is messy, time-consuming, and difficult. You have to have an NGO committee. You have to have government approval. And okay, you can streamline it, but ultimately, NGOs are not apolitical. They are not experts. They are a diverse range of democratic debate and must remain that way. And we mustn't go down anti-democratic roads.
Okay, thank you very much. John, would you like to respond to?
Yeah, I'll try. I don't think that the concept of civil society is a northern construct. I think it's a generally applied one, which one hears as much enthusiasm about the importance of civil society in developing countries as in industrialized countries. And it's actually all, to a large extent, about the democratizing of governance, the enhanced mechanisms of accountability of governments at the local level, at the national level, and at the global level. And so nobody's suggesting that civil society organizations are the route, the only route towards achieving that. But the ability of citizens to have more chance to influence the decisions that affect their lives is so important. And where those decisions are made not just by their national or local governments, but are made at the international arena, it's therefore self-evident that one needs mechanisms that help to connect citizens with the policymakers on those issues. You mentioned the World Bank and the IMF's interest in civil society as being an example of exporting this northern interest in civil society. Well, most NGOs that I know of would say, would raise a question they hadn't heard that the IMF was interested in civil society. The World Bank has become interested for a variety of reasons that's probably far too complicated to go into tonight. But I think that the concerns that the World Bank tends to focus on are issues to do with very specific operations in particular countries or policies that World Bank policies. What we're talking about at a much bigger level are issues to do with the global policies, to do with trade, to do with environmental issues and so on. And there is a disconnect at present, or the panel felt that there was a disconnect at present, that there aren't mechanisms, there's ad hoc processes, and for years to come there will remain to be ad hoc processes. But can one help to move those ad hoc processes to more usual ad hoc processes? So something that might start as being a really interesting experience around one policy issue, for example, the landmines issue. Is it necessary for a 10-year process of learning the ropes, of evolving mechanisms that actually bring concerned governments, like-minded governments who are progressive on that issue, together with the churches and the civil society organisations? Maybe one could short-circuit that, and the UN can play a constructive role in that. That's the sort of thing that we're saying there. In response to Peter Willett's point, I think you're absolutely right with your praise for the panel's report and wrong when it comes to the criticism. The panel, the panel simply doesn't say that people are more legitimate than governments. The panel's report does actually affirm the importance of governments in making decisions in intergovernmental organisations, but is suggesting that those decisions should be informed decisions, and that they should be informed by various conduits, including the global experts, but also including civil society, action, and including social movements and so on, who have a concern about that issue. And the panel also, the panel's report does not say that the Secretariat should select which are the actors. In fact, the present mechanism for selecting, as Malini mentioned, the present mechanism of determining which are the civil society actors, the NGOs, that get into the formal UN forums is an intergovernmental committee of 19 governments who put themselves forward. Most of them put themselves forward for the very reason that they want to stop any more damage being done by these NGOs. They are the ones, if you think about the human rights abusers, the governments who are not welcoming to civil society in their countries, they are the ones who you tend to find on that committee. You do get a few liberal Europeans and so on who deliberately put themselves there to act as a counterbalance. But it is a committee of those who have the hottest views about the subject, which makes it more polarised. Our suggestion is we know that within the next few years, it's probably not going to be able to do away with the opportunity of governments at the end of the day to say who they're comfortable with in their forum, because it is ultimately their forum, as the panel reaffirms. But what we're suggesting is to make it as much as possible a technical decision more than a political decision. And I think Marlise is right on that. That technical, by that we don't mean to say the global experts, but there is a contestation about who has the right to speak for civil society, as it were. And certainly the panel couldn't ignore that debate. It's not just about expertise, but it is also about experience, which isn't necessarily the same as expertise. People living with HIV/AIDS have experience of that issue. People who work with people who live with HIV/AIDS have experience of that issue. And it is also, to some extent, to do with followings. An organisation that can show that they are a widespread social movement, or they're an NGO with a huge global membership and so on, probably does have a certain more, I wouldn't say right to speak, certainly, but it may be that their views and their experience might be more valuable to governments in trying to arrive at decisions on that. So at the moment, there tends to be a little bit of a free-for-all amongst the NGOs, whoever can get to Geneva, whoever can get to New York. And what we're suggesting is to make it a little bit more trying to move it towards ensuring governments that the most relevant actors they get to hear from.
Let me make very, very short remarks on that. Only two. One, refer to IMF. The point with IMF is that IMF doesn't care governments. not civil society. They are not interested at all. So we have to expand, we have to democratize the decision-making process within the IMF by giving more leverage to governments. So it's a much more complicated problem. The second remark is about the what has been said, how to replace the legitimacy, governmental legitimacy by NGOs. It's not that the case. The case is during the deliberation, we have to open doors, open windows to take the benefits of different experience. As John said, at the end, the decision is at the UN at least is always taken by member states, as always in a democracy. But you know, in nowadays, even if you have a lot of votes have been elected, I was twice millions of votes. This is not a base for to take a decision after the day after the election. You have to explain why, you have to be accountable, you have to open your ears to understand what's going on in society, you have to have contact with NGOs, political parties at the local level, at the global level. So in nowadays, you know, it's not enough to have, you know, a representation. That's all this affirmation you have here. On top of representation, you have also to take as valid the experience and the cause proposed by a group of people, even if the group of people has no a formal representation. That's all.
I just want to make the point. I think I hope I wasn't anti-democratic. I'm sorry if I was. I didn't intend to be. I'll give you one case study. I did a certain amount of work a few years ago with a number of Nigerian NGOs who were looking for accreditation to the UN during the Abacha regime in Nigeria, and it was quite clear that the Abacha regime was bending over backwards, twisting arms, threatening UN civil servants, I don't know who, to prevent quite legitimate NGOs getting accreditation to the UN. Now, I think it's anti-democratic if we leave it to governments like the Abacha government to make the decision, yeah, you're okay because you're on my side, but you're not because you're not on my side. Mm-hmm. And I do think the UN Secretariat should have a responsibility to look at the credibility of some of these NGOs and to come forward to your committee or the General Assembly or wherever it's going to with recommendations that these people are genuine and acceptable and should be accredited. And if their government doesn't like it, I don't think the government should have the right of a veto.
Thank you very much. I'd like to take some more questions. The gentleman at the back here, and please, can you give your name and affiliation? And keep your question to one question.
Thank you very much. My name is Antoine Lokongo. I'm a Congolese journalist. If we consider all that we have learned here with regard to the situation in Congo, it's very, very different, whereby it's the same UN system which tramples on the civil society. And I give an example whereby you have UN troops of the MONUC in Congo raping and exploiting young girls as old as 14, 15 sexually. And the civil society rises against that, to denounce that, but they are trampled. The civil society is trampled when they try to rise up against such a situation. And recently you saw people revolting all over the country when it has been clearly established that UN troops in Congo are helping Rwandan troops and the Tutsi Congolese to invade Bukavu when they did so in June. And the civil society rose up and said, this cannot be. If the UN here is not to help us, who else will help us? And I think the debate also at the national level is hijacked now by what you call global governance, because many African governments are threatened. Say, for instance, a government deemed not serious on the issue of AIDS, for instance, those governments in Africa are threatened by the IMF, the World Bank, that they will not get financial aid. Things like that are happening. And you have also other issues like peer reviews in Africa, whereby African leaders come together and they want to assess each other. Oh, maybe President So-so is not doing well, is undemocratic. I think that work needs to be done by the people, not from the top. It has to be done from the bottom. And another thing that really makes me sometimes wonder is, say, for instance, the UN has produced 2 reports on the illegal exploitation of Congo mineral resources during this war of invasion by troops from Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi, supported by multinational. And I don't agree with Malcolm when he say we have to reckon with the power of the, of multinationals, because we have seen after those 2 reports, the UN asked Britain, America, Belgium, France, all these powerful countries who preach democracy to others, to set up a national contact point whereby such group will investigate the activities of multinational behind the troop of invasion in Congo. Nothing has been done in Britain, nothing has been done in America, nothing has been done in France. So I wonder. Thank you very much.
Susan Turbutt, United Nations Association, London and South East Region Executive, and United Nations General Assembly Link UK Executive. The United Nations itself is established primarily to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. What safeguards do you foresee that bringing in a whole new democratic layer of organizations, who many of whom have very small scale and very local interests, such as, say, the future of the inland waterways, and no known views about war or peace, what safeguards are there to ensure that these organizations are actually coming into the United Nations peace movement, so that we are not once again faced with the spectacle of 2 of the most significant international democracies ignoring all the resolutions of the United Nations and pressing forward for a war?
Thank you very much. On the first question,
well, if monarch troops are behaving, or when they behave in the way you have outlined, there are in place procedures that should bring them to justice for the appalling behavior in which they have engaged. And if it's not working properly, we have to look at why it's not working properly and make it work properly. But I think there's another side to your coin. What happens when troops of the RCD Goma rape young women? Who is actually going to bring them to task? There is nobody who's going to bring them to task. They will actually enjoy impunity for their terrible misbehavior. And in a civil war situation, which is what it is in the Congo, it's very difficult to know what to do with the rebels who don't have the same, at least notional, structures of justice for misbehavior. And I think that's a very, perhaps it's an impossible situation to be able to answer properly. I don't think the UN troops helped the Rwandese invade Bukavu. I think that is a misinterpretation of the facts. I think that their mandate was not strong enough, their presence on the ground was not sufficient, they were not able to prevent the intervention in Bukavu, which is different from saying they actually went out to help them. And I think perhaps we can have a chat about that afterwards. UNA over the years has probably done more than any other NGO in Britain on the kleptocracy reports, the 3, I think, UN reports on the rape of the economy of the Eastern Congo. And I don't think it was multinational corporations so much. I think the government and the military of Rwanda and Uganda were deeply implicated, very, very high officials, members of the presidential families, and so on. They were all involved in doing this. And there were a number of companies, some of them not very big, who were named and shamed. There were individuals who were named and shamed in the UN reports. Some of them were British citizens, some of them were British registered companies. They are the ones we were interested in. We tried to get our government to take action against them. They promised they were going to, and absolutely nothing has happened. And they say that it's very difficult because international legislation is lacking and national legislation is too weak, blah, 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 and they did nothing. And I believe that, I agree with you, that on those kleptocracy reports, I think the inaction of the UN Security Council and of member states whose nationals or companies were involved in that is absolutely scandalous. And I think the impunity that Presidents Museveni and Kagame have enjoyed in relation to the rape of the economy of Eastern Congo is another major scandal.
But in any case, that kind of problem implies governments, not civil society. Our report was on the engagement of civil society in UN, not regarding what you asked for. But can you reply what they asked?
Certainly. I suppose the objective is to ensure that there is a much higher penalty when the UN resolutions are not adhered to make it less politically possible for UN resolutions to be ignored. And there are various aspects to that, but all of which are to do with making the UN and the international system more powerful. It requires resources, it requires sort of better staff and all of these things. I don't think anybody in the panel would suggest that the mechanisms it's proposing are the only ones, but I suppose two of the elements of making it more difficult for the UN resolutions to be ignored. One is to increase the moment of the UN in the eyes of the world, and the importance of engaging civil society in part is to achieve that, to focus on issues of accountability. And there is accountability of the UN, and it's right that civil society is challenging the UN for if there are failings in Rwanda or wherever, that is put under a microscope. But it's also important that governments are held accountable for their actions in the UN forums. And, you know, I think it would be good if quite routinely every member of the Security Council was subjected to both parliamentary scrutiny, to civil society scrutiny, to media scrutiny as to how they used their seats in the Security Council. So that's part of it. The other part of it is information being power, and that again goes back to the point of what the panel is suggesting about the mechanisms by which the civil society can be conduits for very important information. Certainly when it comes to questions like Congo, there's a very clear conviction that if the Security Council, which is the body that within the international system that discusses that sort of event, that if they routinely got out of the field, out of the UN headquarters in New York, and went and saw it for themselves, they would come back with a very different idea of it. I mean, just spending a few days, and who's so busy that they can't spend a few days looking at an issue like that, and in that time met with the different key players, then they would come back not only with better information, but a certain passion that this issue has to be solved. So I think that it's those things would empower the UN.
Let's also add that the Secretary General asked for another panel dealing directly on Security Council and the main, you know, structural questions in reforming the UN system. This panel is still working. And probably one of the questions have been raised here about the USA government reaction have to be discussed during this, you know, the based on this second, you know, panel. As you know, the modification of Security Council is a old idea, and it's extremely difficult to implement. And anyhow, I suppose the other panel is ready to prepare some suggestions, much more difficult yet than ours, and as important as.
Exactly. Yeah, just very quickly, I want to follow up on the lady who reminds me of Emmeline Pankhurst. The lady from the United Nations Association. Two quick things, really. I mean, the first is on civil society organizations who engage with the United Nations, there is a presumption that their predisposition is to support the United Nations Charter, peace, development, human rights, etc. However, you have anomalies, such that you have the National Rifle Association, which has consultative status with ECOSOC, and you have the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which has consultative status. And the two must live under the same roof, coming back to the issue of pluralism that Marlies raised. You already have that. However, the issue, because of doublespeak and because of, you know, whoever speaks the loudest, their propaganda wins. For governments, is that they're terribly confused. Now, on the issue of our report, for example, many countries which would be the kind of flag bearers for more civil society access within the United Nations say, well, we've been getting really confused responses from NGOs. So if NGOs aren't backing this, the recommendations of this report, we're just going to sit on it. And so where that is concerned, there needs to be clarity, yes, but clarity by much greater information going their way and very compelling cases made. But if you don't agree with all of 30 recommendations that we've made, agree at least with the general principles, because the general principles themselves aren't even agreed on. So there, I think, there really is a very, very hard case of lobbying which needs to be urgently done. Just one quick thing to bring us up to speed on what's happening in another room down the road in this city. The Prime Minister's giving his Mansion House speech this evening, where he's going to be outlining the new direction for foreign policy, particularly with regard to what's going to appear in the election manifesto, in election manifesto for Labour next year. And one of the things that he's going to flag is that the United Kingdom must be much more attentive to dealing with countries which are currently at risk of instability and engage in the United Nations much more. Now, if that's the case, we all want to see a stiffened and a much more effective United Nations. I mean, we have to bring together the kind of rhetorical flourishes which are made at those kind of events with some of the serious recommendations which countries are deliberating on and yet unable to reach any resolution in the General Assembly. And there I see a very, very obvious, this is your day job as a General Assembly link person. But I think looking at quickly ahead to the future, you know, what's the average age in this room? Mid-20s? We need to get young people involved in this, right? And they're not getting involved in Western societies because the eunuchs are getting out of business. United Nations Information Centres. And one of the things that I completely, you know, screamed until I was blue in the face on the panel was, we need United Nations Information Centres in Western countries. If we don't have them, then people in countries like the UK will think, oh, United Nations, it's only for dealing with peace, security, humanitarian conflicts in godforsaken parts of the third world. It's got nothing to do with us. And so there is already an intellectual and emotional gulf with the United Nations. And in order to resurrect that, we need, okay, you know, let's get, I don't know, let's get Virgin guy, you know, Richard Branson, to fund the eunuch. Get someone, big dosh, who is committed to multilateralism to fund these things and to shame governments. Because otherwise, you know, 60 years of the UN, we may not see 70 years. That's the reality.
The closure of the national eunuchs was one of the worst decisions I can remember in 23 years as director of the UNA. And I think I agree we'd have to fight it and get it reversed, but it won't happen in the short term.
Okay, and I think there we will have to finish. And I would like to thank all the panellists for their very stimulating responses and also the audience for their stimulating questions. And perhaps I'll finish with the words of Malini, who urged us as actors in civil society to lobby our member states to take this very important document seriously. And I think you've laid out for us a very important task. Thank you.
Thank you.